Hello, my name is Philip Muirton, and this is Conversations Beyond Science and Religion. My website is heavenattheendofscience.com, and you could find podcasts of these shows on another site, Conversations Beyond Science and Religion. Now, today's conversation is a big one on a very popular topic. The topic is what science can tell us about staying younger longer, about delaying the aging process, defeating the ravages of time. Now, this thought about staying younger longer, living longer, is as old as the human race. It goes back to the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita. There's the famous Fountain of Youth, where Ponce de Leon supposedly found a mystical spring in Florida on, I believe, the second of Christopher Columbus's voyages that was supposed to give those who drank from the spring eternal life. We also know from the billions of dollars spent on anti-aging medication and creams that staying younger, looking younger, is one of humankind's most primitive and basic quests. But is this a quest that is just another New Age dream? Some New Agers say that we are immortal spiritual beings, such as Michael McIntosh said on an earlier show. Well, this is easy to say, but what does science have to report upon this important topic? Does science have anything to say about staying younger longer? Or is this just a topic for those dreamers who will never actually execute on their dream? Now, fortunately, the cover story of the recent issue of Scientific America says something about science and what science is doing about anti-aging. The cover story is The Pathway of Youth, New Insights into the Body's Aging Control System. So indeed, science is working on this all-important problem. There's a group of scientists in the field of gerontology who are in fact on the quest to solve the mystery of aging. Now, to give us a progress report on this quest, I'm happy to have on the show one of the leading authorities on the science of aging. His name is David Stipp. He is the author of the Scientific American article I just mentioned, as well as the book entitled The Youth Pill, Scientists on the Brink of an Anti-Aging Revolution. Now, Mr. Stipp is a former senior writer for Fortune magazine and a former staff reporter for the Wall Street Journal, where he covered science, medicine, and technology. In 2006, he wrote a front-page story for the Wall Street Journal that broke the news that the ingredient in red wine produces an anti-aging effect in mice. Welcome to the show, Mr. Stipp.
Thank you very much.
Now, let's get right to this for a minute, Mr. Stipp. You've been studying this field for quite a while, I understand. Is that right?
Yes, over 10 years.
And now, from your study, why do we grow old? What can you tell us about that topic?
Well, I think there are two ways to answer that question, or basically two approaches to try to investigate it. I think the most how should I put it? The most telling way to get into this question is to look at the evolutionary reasons that might explain why we age. And although the argument is a little complex, I think it could be boiled down to the fact that after reproductive prime, after the sort of prime of life, most animals have reproduced, the force of evolution tends to diminish as far as preserving bodily integrity. And over time, then, the various insults that cause molecular damage are free to act or more free to act, and their cumulative force causes us to go downhill over time and become more prone to various diseases that can kill us. The other approach to this question is perhaps more harder to get into, but more fruitful as far as being able to do something about aging, and that is to try to figure out exactly what's happening at the molecular level that leads to the decline and deterioration over time. And that has been going on for a long time. For at least 100 years, scientists have been looking into this and occasionally proclaiming they've figured it out. aging is very complicated. Many factors are coming into play as far as causing damage. So I don't think there's a real simple answer to that question the way there is pretty much to the evolutionary question of why we age. This question might be phrased, how we age. There's no simple answer there, but we're getting some clues about things that can be done as far as interventions that might slow down some of the damage.
Yeah, I think that one of the sort of confusions here is whether aging itself is a disease or whether aging is sort of a natural degradation of the human cells. Based upon your research, would you conclude that aging itself is a disease or is independent of diseases?
That's a very interesting and deep question. I sometimes think of it as, you know, it's kind of simply a semantic question, whether you're willing to apply the word disease to this kind of massive thing that goes wrong with all of us over time. And my preference would be not to label it a disease, and I'll just address briefly the semantic question first on that. I think that word is best reserved for things that afflict limited segments of the population, and it's kind of, expanding the definition of that word unduly, perhaps, to call something that hits all of us, and which has long been thought to be just a normal thing and probably should be regarded as a normal thing, as a disease. I like to say Michael Jordan didn't retire from the NBA because he was sick.
Yeah.
You know, my preference is to say that aging is a process that makes us vulnerable to disease. There's a very close tie between disease and aging, obviously. I think we all know that. But I think disease, or rather aging, should be thought of as kind of a normal process that makes us prone to disease. And that, I'll just add, that's what got me into this field, or got me very interested in following this field, because as a medical writer, I just discovered that everything I was covering that was important in terms of diseases, the number one risk factor was getting older. And it just struck me that, well, if we could do something about that risk factor, wow, we would be able to basically slow down the progression of or the onset of every single thing, pretty much, that afflicts us as we get older. So that's what got me interested in this whole field.
That's interesting. I know in I believe it's in the Youth Pill, your book, where you have a discussion about whether science or medical science should be focusing on aging itself to delay aging in order to prevent the onset or delay the onset of diseases, or whether it should be focusing on the individual diseases. And I believe at one point you say that, well, it would be really, it seems like it's a, you would kill many birds with one stone if there was a way to delay the onset of aging, because that in itself, it seems, would delay the onset of these old age diseases.
Exactly. Right. That's in a nutshell what makes this research more promising, I think, than any other as far as yielding new medicines on the horizon here. I think a good analogy would be the way we've over the past 40 or 50 years we've learned in medicine to push off heart disease, largely I think by lessening risk factors for it in middle age. That is, we now with drugs can lower blood pressure and cholesterol. And, of course, we have lifestyle interventions that we tell people about, too, that can help. And so heart disease, really, you know, our fathers or mothers' generation would perhaps have often, you know, you often hear about people dying of heart attacks in their 50s. That doesn't happen much anymore.
Yeah.
Yet we've really pushed off that disease to a much later date. But what if we could do something similar with a drug that, that basically pushed off everything? You know, I'm talking about Alzheimer's disease, cancer, arthritis, and even the cosmetic changes of aging to a later date, buying us quality time, extending the period of midlife vibrancy. We're talking about sort of do-all preventive drugs, basically, when we're talking about this thing. And so I just want to stress, if there's one bottom line to all of this, it's not that we're talking about radical life extension or something like that. We're talking about mainly boosting the quality of life in the most cost-effective way we can, possibly extending it a bit, but mainly making us able to age in a more healthy way.
Yeah, I think that there's probably, and I would agree that there is a lot of semantics involved in this discussion, and we've already touched upon a couple of them, the difference between the concept of disease and aging. And another one is, what does it mean to extend life? I titled the show Staying Younger Longer, which to me sounds better than living longer, because if you just live longer, well, to be old and live longer may not be such a great thing. Maybe it's better than the alternative, but what you're saying, it seems to me, is that one quest of science would be to delay the onset of these bad diseases and to promote a longer, healthy life, right? So is that your focus? In other words, the focus is having a longer, healthy life rather than length for the sake of living longer.
Oh, absolutely. It always is. I don't think any rational person who's ever looked at this whole issue would think, oh, let's just extend life, even if it's just prolonging agony toward the end,
right.
Increasing the period of morbidity at the end of life. Nobody,
yeah.
nobody in aging science has ever considered that a remote goal.
Yeah.
It's always been to extend what people call health span,
yeah.
as much and perhaps more than extending lifespan. Yeah. And I think if you look at the research on animals, and one of the take-home messages of the research of the past 20 years in aging science is that the rate of aging is amazingly plastic. I mean, we used to think you just couldn't do anything about aging, that it was just sort of set. Some people died later than others, but really as the species as a whole, there was no intervention you could do to address all the sort of random, chaotic, bad things that are happening as you get older at the cellular and molecular level. Not true. It's now very definitely known that you can affect the rate of aging with interventions that aren't all that hard or complex in animals, and perhaps you can do it in humans too. So the whole thing about these interventions is that they don't increase the period of morbidity at the end of life. Rather, in every case where we've been able to dramatically extend animals' lifespan, what we've actually done is extended their health spans. And that has pushed out the amount of time that they've been able to live. But all these interventions, again, they buy quality time for animals. They extend the period of vibrancy before they get to their terminal declines.
Yeah. Okay, now, with regard to where science is on this spectrum, and I'm going to ask you on a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 is science has no idea how to prevent aging, and 10 being that the cure is now available at the corner drugstore, where would you put science's progress right now in discovering the solution to aging?
I'll give you a stab at a number, but I'd like to briefly elaborate on what I mean by it. I would say we're about maybe 70% there, and the 30% that we're not, that remains is would be, among other things, and very importantly, figuring out ways to assess the rate of aging without having to wait, 80 years to see if something that somebody is taking actually makes them live longer. So that's a very hard problem to figure out, what people call biomarkers of aging that would let us actually look in a very rapid way and tell whether somebody is biologically going downhill faster or slower or at the same rate as a result of taking some sort of intervention, be it a drug or a lifestyle thing. More research needs to be done on that issue. It's a hard nut to crack, and there's not a lot of money to address it right now. But I would say the real issue about all this research is that there's, so far, very little public will to put the kind of significant investment that you would need to take this research out of the lab, you know, from the R stage to the D stage, so to speak, from research into development. And that's, I think, the biggest hindrance. It would be much, I think there's much bigger obstacles that would be classified as political and social rather than scientific at this point.
That's interesting. I was going to ask you what were the major obstacles, and maybe you could try to elaborate a little bit about what the resistance is. It would seem to me that from the drug company standpoint, that this would be a incredibly rich area of research and development.
Actually, it's just, your intuition is exactly what I think most people's would be and what mine would have been some time back. But in fact, when you look at the details of the situation, just the opposite. The drug companies don't care a bit about this area. Why? The reason is if they have to invest, say, $1 billion, $2 billion, $5 billion to develop a drug, they have to sell it as a prescription drug for a great deal of profit. There's just no way they wouldn't be in business. We would not have any drugs at all unless the drug companies can make some money. And the only way they can make money when they have to do this incredibly risky, difficult 10 to 15-year process to develop a drug is to charge a lot of money for it. And the only way you can do that is if you have regulatory approval and the FDA presumes or has set up a framework to say, yes, this is a drug that treats a disease and it works. Now, aging is not considered a disease. We're getting back to the question you asked earlier. At least by regulatory agencies and probably, I would say, by the whole medical establishment at this point. And it's moreover, it's just not considered a condition, so to speak, that's worthy or can be mitigated. And so there's no regulatory framework to get a prescription drug approved that would slow the rate of aging. So drug companies have zero interest in they don't even talk about it. It's just untenable. If you went to the FDA with an anti-aging drug, it would be kind of like going to the Federal Aviation Administration and saying, do you want a license to fly flying pigs or something?
that's just something that's amazing to me. I mean, I keep thinking, every time I think about anti-aging, I think about one of my least favorite sayings, which is, you know, all that we're assured about in life are death and taxes. And perhaps taxes is more certain based upon what your research is showing and based upon what the politicians are up to. But are you saying that that because the medical profession or the pharmaceutical business doesn't view aging as a disease, that therefore it's not something that they're interested in curing?
I don't want to get into the issue of whether aging is a disease or not on this. I would prefer to just say the real issue here is that the regulators, nor and the medical establishment, or those who basically are thought leaders in medicine, at this point don't regard aging as a problem that can be mitigated or should be mitigated. I'm not quite sure which one. You know, different people have different perspectives on this, but I think the bottom line is that most of people in medicine are specialists, and they don't have time to track what's happening in other fields. So I think actually a lot of people who know a lot, say, about cancer or heart disease, don't really know what's happened in aging science. They don't track gerontology, and they don't grasp the full details of what gerontologists have been able to do in animals with regard to slowing aging. And so they're perhaps just unaware of what of that the ground has shifted under us on, in this whole pursuit of ways to slow aging. And as a result, our whole political and social and regulatory framework is lagging behind what's happened in the science by a lot. I don't know what would change that, but certainly it would help if people would realize that we can extend health span in animals very handily now. And that suggests that we probably could do it in humans too if we had the money to develop all this stuff.
Now, you've studied this field for quite a long time, and your book, The Youth Pill, as I've mentioned, does a very nice job of going through, at least at that time, the cutting edge of anti-aging treatments and research. If you were in control of, say, a pharmaceutical company or the FDA, what would you do? What would be your recommendation on what kind of resources, if any, to devote to the anti-aging research and development?
Well, I think the government entity that would need to address this would be the National Institutes of Health, and in particular the National Institute on Aging. And it does have a research program on the basic biology of aging, but I would say there's not, the fraction of NIH money that goes into that field is less than 0.5% of the NIH's. But I mean, it's tiny, partly because, as I said, the whole medical world has long been focused on individual diseases, and this whole idea of aging is a big, broad thing sort of outside the basic framework that medical research is done, which is always specializing in particular organs or particular diseases, not this vast, mysterious thing we call aging. So I would put a lot more money into the basic biology of the National Institute on Aging to kind of build, at first, this thing I was talking about earlier, research on biomarkers of aging. So if we had something that we thought might slow down aging in humans, we have a decent way to test it by being able to look and see if there are various parameters or things inside a person that you could measure that would show, oh yeah, we can see the rate of aging has been slowed by this intervention.
I was going to say one of the questions that sort of appeals to me, or one of the areas that is of interest, is, you mentioned that as people age, they're more susceptible to these killer diseases, cancer, heart disease, diabetes, osteoporosis, etc. Now, if through some incredible advance in science, let's say centuries from now, we have cures for all of these diseases, all of these killer diseases, a question would be, well, are we still aging anyways? Are we still, I guess that goes to the question whether the bodily cells are naturally deteriorating. But do you think that if through some miracle or breakthroughs these major killer diseases are cured, that we're still going to age and die?
That's a very good question, and it's I think impossible to answer at this point. Partly because when you look at what has happened, I mean, consider the kinds of diseases that mainly afflict us in old age has changed over time.
Yeah.
It used to be the thing we humans had to worry about mainly was infectious diseases early in the 20th century, childhood mortality in the developed world, and still to some extent in the developing world, this is true. Then it became, in the middle of the century, I think, if you had to single out something to worry about, it was heart disease, as well as cancer, but heart disease in particular seemed to be, what would happen to you as you got older. Now, what people, I think, really worry about more is dementing diseases, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, whatever. as well as other forms of sort of progressive, slow killing diseases. Cancer has become much more treatable, but it also can become a kind of long-term disease for some people. So I think what this shows is that as we've pushed out life expectancy, the kinds of things, the kinds of diseases that we would have to wrestle with are going to change, and they're probably going to get harder to deal with. Alzheimer's, I think, has proved a much tougher nut to crack than midlife heart attacks. I mean, this, you can just see what's happened in medicine to buy that idea.
Yeah.
And so the idea that we could cure every single thing that might afflict us as we gradually push ourselves, our life expectancy out farther and farther is, I'm a little skeptical that we, some
yeah.
various things would crop up, I think, that might be just too challenging to deal with, at least for the science at that time. The bottom line to me is, though, that we know how to slow down the rate of aging in animals. And so we don't have to, it's far more cost-effective and faster and just generally easier to pursue medicines, these preventive medicines that would slow down aging, than to try to address each single killer disease one at a time, usually after much of the damage is done late in life when it's, a lot of it's irreversible, I think.
Seems good.
Just look at the cost of geriatric medicine today, how it's skyrocketing. Why is that? It's because we're trying to push back against various diseases of aging one at a time, late in the game.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to argue with your premise that by delaying aging, or by devoting resources to delaying aging, we are canvassing many more diseases. We're pushing back, at least theoretically, the onset of these diseases, therefore extending the time for a healthy life. And like science itself progresses by experiments, obviously there's a lot of testing and experiments that need to be done to see how this would work, but it just makes a lot of sense that to devote resources to pushing the aging process forward and at the same time seeing what impact that has on the onset of these killer diseases. Now I want to be clear for the listeners that what you're talking about, you're not talking about immortality here. What you're talking about is that there's studies, and mostly with these poor little mice, and maybe a fish here or there, and I think you had this naked mole rat, but mostly mice, mostly rodents, about extending life percentage points. What is it, 10 to 30% or something? So is that right?
I think most people these days are in gerontology are thinking, yes, it's probably technically feasible at this point to extend healthy lifespan by 5 to 10%. It doesn't sound like much, but I just wanted to throw out one thing to people because we were on the subject of killer diseases and addressing them one at a time. It's if you could completely wipe out cancer, cure it totally, you would extend life expectancy at this point by only about 3 years in the United States. Why is that? Well, that's really surprising. When I first saw that, I was quite startled. But the reason is, as we get to the age where cancer risks are going up very fast, that is over 65, the risk of everything is going up that can go wrong, is going up very fast. In fact, it's growing exponentially. And so even if we're completely free of cancer and can never die from it again, something else is waiting there in the wings to get us pretty rapidly. So I think, you know, what this shows to me is that this is the most cost-effective way to really get into extending lifespan modestly. And I just wanted to again, stress what you already said. This is not about immortality. This is not even about, in my view, radical life extension. It's about modest life extension, but especially buying us quality time more effectively than say, even curing cancer or completely curing heart disease.
Yeah, I thought that your point about the cancer, and I think you've made the same point about heart disease in the youth pill about even if we cured cancer, heart disease, it's only 3 more years. I thought that was something that most people probably don't understand or appreciate, that all the money spent on cancer research, and I don't know what it is, but it's got to be in the billions of dollars. And the same thing for heart disease, that we're really only looking at 3 years because something else is going to get you. I thought that was something that needs to be advertised more. I mean, 3 years is 3 years, but your point that, again, devoting resources to the aging itself seems to be more bang for the buck.
Yeah, that's exactly the point here. And this is not to denigrate research on cancer at all. It's just to point out that as far as bang for buck, we're really missing the boat here. We're just not, to use another cliché, we're not putting as much money into what I think would be very productive and fruitful research with regard to all diseases of aging than we should. And you know, I don't know when that will change. It's certainly been a hard row to hoe.
Yeah, okay, well, right now, based upon your research, what do you think is the most promising treatment out there right now? What's the number one anti-aging R&D project going on in your mind?
Well, I don't think there's a, unfortunately, I can't point out to a single one where we should just concentrate all our efforts, because I think there are several avenues to pursue here that are promising. But in general, I just like to point out two or three programs or you know, general areas of research that I think are very exciting and might lead to drugs. And I should preface everything and say there's no intervention on the market right now that's known to slow aging, and anybody who's claiming otherwise is simply trying to sell you something that's not proven. So, first of all, I think this thing called calorie restrictions, research on that, this was discovered in 1935, that if you severely restrict calorie intake in animals in a way that doesn't starve them, you give them an adequate diet, but it's just very low in calories, it's like very severe dieting, they live a lot longer and they live a lot healthier too. This has been tried in everything from yeast cells all the way up through dogs. And also, it's now there's a long ongoing experiment, actually two, in rhesus monkeys that's suggesting that it works in primates too, and so it very well may work in humans. The problem is nobody can diet that stringently. At least the masses can't. I certainly can't. A few people seem to be able to. So the hope is to develop a drug that turns on the same metabolic pathways, so to speak, in the body that calorie restriction does, without turning on the hunger pangs of it. And if they could do that, I think that might be what we're talking about here, a drug that would push out healthy life expectancy by 5 to 10 years, maybe more. The other, or I'll just mention one other area because time is short, I'm sure. There are genes that are now known that if there are certain variants of them or certain mutations of them can drastically slow aging in animals. So we've long known in biotechnology how to mimic the effects of certain genes with drugs. That's not too hard. We've been doing it for a long time. And we now, as of 2009, actually know a drug that can affect one enzyme or one genetic pathway called TOR, targeted rapamycin, in various animal species. And rapamycin is actually a drug on the market right now. It's used in kidney transplant and other organ transplant patients to prevent rejection of their organs. It was the first drug that was very conclusively shown to extend lifespan in mammals in 2009. And so I think this sort of research, focusing on certain pathways where we know there are genes that affect the rate of aging, and targeting them with drugs that might mimic those genes is very promising too.
Yeah, I thought that the discussion, the calorie restriction angle, which is something that a lot of people have heard about, and it sounds like that will never work in the Western world. It will, we know it will not work in the U.S. It's perhaps some people would try it, but I think you're right. I couldn't do it, and I think most people couldn't physically restrict their calories to the point where it's near starvation to gain a couple years. But it seemed as if a lot of these drugs or treatments that are in an experimental stage right now, as you say, are trying to mimic the genetic effect of the calorie restriction. Is that right?
I think, yes. I think that's probably been, for the last 10 years, maybe the most productive way to go in research on how to slow down aging. But again, there's an overlap here between gene mutations that slow aging and calorie restriction. It looks as though, in some cases, they turn on the same pathways in the body, in particular this one I just mentioned called TOR, targeted
right.
rapamycin.
Right.
So that makes that particularly exciting. That was, by the way, the subject of the Scientific American article I recently wrote.
Right, right. But unfortunately, this rapamycin has some side effects, right? I mean, there's some.
Indeed, it does. It has a bunch of side effects. Although, and people I think have generally dismissed it as a possible anti-aging drug, and that's probably correct. But I would just point out that a lot of the side effects we know about in rapamycin have been observed in studies of the drug when it's been given to very sick people. I mean, people who get organ transplants are in pretty perilous shape. And sometimes you can't really judge very well what the effects of a drug in small doses might be given to a healthy person as compared to given to a very sick person who's on multiple drugs that may be interacting, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, rapamycin probably is not the drug that we're going to want to try, but it may be a rapamycin-like drug that works in much the same way that has fewer side effects could be discovered that might will do the trick.
Yeah, and we cannot forget the red wine resveratrol, which you wrote. Go ahead.
Right, there's been some negative news in the last year or so on resveratrol and that area of research that it sort of falls in, which is the study of these things called sirtuins, which are certain enzymes that seem to be involved in possibly the effects of calorie restriction. And I just have to say, I think the naysayers have gotten a little bit carried away now. I mean, at first there was too much hype about resveratrol, I think, especially by people who wanted to sell it as a dietary supplement.
Yeah.
And then there was kind of the usual backlash after a while, and we're sort of still in the backlash period. And I think the truth about resveratrol is it's very promising to lower risk factors for major diseases of aging, particularly heart disease and diabetes. In the literature, in the scientific research in mammals, that is rodents mainly, there's all kinds of exciting developments, and it's the literature is now just huge on this. People who have lately been naysaying resveratrol, saying we were all just taken for a ride on this, are simply focusing on a small number of studies in lower organisms which have clarified the picture but don't at all give the bottom line on what's going on here. So I don't know that resveratrol would slow aging in mammals. I don't know that it will extend maximum lifespan in mammals. But I think it's safe to say at this point that it's very promising as a possible agent or things like it, drugs that work like it, to mitigate the risk of broad swath of diseases of aging, which is, nothing to sniff at.
I have to tell you that makes me very happy. I mean, I'm sure that you got a lot of positive feedback from your Wall Street Journal article 5-6 years ago when you broke the story or wrote the cover story about the health benefits, aging benefits of red wine. Anytime the American public hears that something that was supposed to be bad for you is actually good for you, it probably makes you very popular. So that's good to hear. And I have seen some of those articles going both ways. And I think that the American public sometimes doesn't appreciate that a lot of these articles in the media are picking out different studies when there's hundreds of studies. And
There's over 4,000 studies on resveratrol that you can look if you go to the National Library of Medicine's website. And recently there was a big furor in the press because a researcher at the University of Connecticut was accused of I'm not quite sure what the exact accusation was, but it called into question his research on resveratrol. And the fact is, he had a total of 58. There were a total of 58 research articles in the literature that he was a co-author on. So let's just say cancel all 58 of those articles. What percentage of the grand total on resveratrol? I mean, it's trivial.
Yeah.
It's hardly a blip. It really doesn't matter. The great body of research is still sound, and it's coming from all over the world by a lot of labs.
Yeah, well, that is really promising, and I think that it sort of helps the wine industry. We know that the quantities of red wine that someone would have to drink in order to get the dose is what cases and cases a day
yeah,
or something.
I think that's still an issue, though. I mean, I don't recommend that people go out and take resveratrol supplements.
Right.
I don't myself. Partly because I still haven't seen enough research to have a sense for what kind of dose might do some good and exactly what kind of good it might do. I'm a very conservative sort of Midwestern type, show me the data sort of guy. But I think those who might be interested in what's now developing in the clinic, because there are now some small clinical trials out there in resveratrol, and want to consider doing a personal experiment with this stuff, they would still have to take a dietary supplement. You probably could not get the kind of doses we're seeing in these studies with wine without doing serious harm to yourself.
Yeah. I wanted to ask from your perspective, for somebody who wants to live longer or live healthier longer, What would you recommend they do, based on what?
Well, the very first thing that I always recommend, if you can get me to recommend, and I'm pretty reluctant, but I will for a moment here, and that is exercise. There's so many lines of research in the world of gerontology that show, the way things typically work out, we'll find a pathway that slows aging in animals, and then start looking into the details and the knock-on effects and how it all works, and then eventually somebody will do a research study where they'll just look at animals that are heavily exercising, and they'll say, oh, look, that pathway is turned on in those animals.
Yeah.
So I don't know that exercise will extend lifespan. In fact, there's very little animal data suggesting that it will. It is absolutely sure that it will extend health span. So the amount of time that you've got on the planet, if you want to spend it in good health, good vibrant health, and not be going downhill with many different diseases, it's exercise. And I think this is the hardest thing for people to do, to regularly exercise in a very consistent way over their lives. I mean, people sometimes rarely can eat right.
Yes, yes.
It's doable. Exercising, even though we see lots of joggers out there, I think the number of people who really regularly exercise for many, many years of their lives is pretty small. So that's the number one thing I would say to people. The other thing is, don't eat much sugar. I really think there's a lot of research. When anybody who starts looking into research on gerontology soon starts to see that one of the main things that seems to be one of the main pathways in the body that's related to aging is the insulin pathway. The insulin, of course, is the hormone that helps control blood sugar. Now, when insulin gets out of whack, which it does in many people as they age, even if they eat right, it seems to be to help speed up or at least not help slow down the rate of aging. How do you keep your insulin in check over time? How do you keep it normal? Don't eat a lot of sugar.
Yeah.
Don't eat a lot of high glycemic things. I mean, it's sort of what our moms may have told us or our doctors.
Yeah.
And it seems like a cliche, but it's from the aging literature, it's coming out loud and clear. Avoid big doses of sugary things.
Yeah, well, it's funny that those two things, exercise and don't eat sugar, seem to be, it's a miracle that people are living longer, because, as you say, we eat a lot of sugar, and people that regularly exercise are probably not as many as one would think. And we could go into that for all the reasons, but I think it's most people would probably know what the answer is that we have other things to do, TV to watch, restaurants to go to, etc. But it's nice to know that the old-fashioned way works. And now you yourself, though, have you experimented with either
resveratrol?
Yes, the red wine ingredient, or with rapamycin?
No. Rapamycin is a prescription drug.
Okay.
And it as mentioned earlier, it has significant side effects.
Right.
In lots of people, although it's a little, as I said, a little unclear exactly to what degree they would hit in a healthy adult. But I've never tried, I've never taken supplements of either of those,
yes.
Mainly because, as I said, I think resveratrol, I think, is a pretty safe substance. You have to take an awful lot of it to have toxic effects, it turns
yes.
out, at least from what we know in the human and animal studies so far. So personal experiments with it, I don't think, are terribly risky unless you just totally go overboard. But I just don't have a good enough sense for how much I'd need to take to do good.
Yeah.
And so I'm one of the more conservative people, I guess, on this,
yeah.
or at least somewhat conservative.
So
I certainly have experimented with calorie restriction briefly, mainly just to see what it was like and see, you know, how hard or easy it might be, and I myself found it quite hard to maintain that kind of rigorous low-calorie diet. In fact, I only stuck with it for a few days.
Yeah, it's probably hard. It's probably hard to have a lot of friends if you're on a calorie-restricted diet.
That's a very good point,
<You know>?
Indeed. I mean, eating has a lot to do with what goes on between us as social beings.
Right.
I mean, it's just not pleasant to be the ascetic in the crowd at dinner parties. So.
Yeah. That's part of the reason why, I tell you, if calorie restriction turned out to be the answer, I still think it would be hard to implement. And I think that most people would say, okay, dear modern science, invent us a pill that mimics the effect of calorie restriction. And just like the research is pointing to right now. Now, what is your next stage of research? What are you doing now?
Well, I'm not focused on any particular part of aging science. That has become my specialty, and the thing I tend to focus on most as a science writer. But you know, the whole field is moving pretty rapidly. Things keep happening all the time, and most recently, I just mentioned one thing I got interested in that is a very complex but fascinating subject, and that is what's called cellular senescence. It turns out science has known for a long time that our cells tend to stop dividing at a certain point, and that perhaps limits their ability to renew and restore damaged or worn-out tissues. And that, a lot of people have thought this may be at the heart of aging. Over the years, although the evidence is kind of mixed on that. But recently, there's been some very interesting developments on that front, showing that in mice, if there's a kind of clever genetic trick you can use to remove cells from the bodies of mice as they go into this kind of senescent state,
yeah.
It really seems to have quite a remarkable effect about sort of preserving or fending off some of the bad things that happen as the animals get older. So that's quite an interesting area right now, and one of the things I'm focused on.
Yeah. Now, do you have another book planned or articles under preparation or?
Well, I do have a couple of things that I'm working on in terms of articles. I don't have a book at this point that I'm working on, but at some point it may all come together for another book.
Yeah. Well, I thought that I would highly recommend those listeners who want to know more about this very intriguing topic to pick up the last issue. I think it's the last issue of Scientific American, and read Mr. Stipp's front page article on the pathway of youth. His book is called The Youth Pill, Scientists on the Brink of an Anti-Aging Revolution. There is a lot more on this topic I'm sure we're going to hear about in the future. I want to also compliment you, Mr. Stipp, on one of the best quotes I've ever seen to begin a book, which I think says it all. In the beginning of his book, he quotes from Ashley Montague, who says, "The idea is to die young as late as possible," which I think, as I said, says it all. I'd like to thank you very much, Mr. Stipp, for your time. Now, you do blog on this topic. I think it's www.davidstipp.com.
That's right.
That's your website. And I've mentioned your book and your article. I'd like to thank you for your time. Here today has been very educational, and maybe we'll follow up with you in a year or two to see where things are at. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.